what, do I have to let go and talk? I just stay up here, all right?
Hi, everybody. My name is Cliff Rose, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic. Amen. And I hope God's got a good message for y'all, because I just asked him to clear my head and clear my thinking, and he did. And there's nothing left up there. But hopefully, heard a friend one time talk about being afraid of getting up to the podium and messing somebody up. And he was pacing around, and an old guy asked him, and he said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "Well, I'm afraid I'm going to mess somebody up." And the guy said, "Now, you've got a higher power now, right?" He said, "Yes." He said, "They've all got a higher power." "Yeah." "Do you think your higher power is going to let you mess anybody up?" And he said he felt a whole lot better and a lot calmer after he said that, until he was walking up the steps to the podium, and the guy said, "Now, God may need you to show someone your ass today, but he won't let you mess anybody up." So I am just praying like the devil that I don't need to show my ass today. But if I do, I some mornings my prayer is simply, "Dear God, please don't need me as a bad example today. But if you do, let me do it with grace and dignity and not have to take a drink over." And there have been many, many times in my recovery that I've had to be a bad example. But thanks to all the steps, I've been able to get through it without taking a drink, which is a miracle. My last drink was September 26, 1995, but I count my sobriety date as May 27th, 2005. And hopefully you'll see why, because for me, sobriety is the ability to live life on God's terms without taking any mind-altering substance whatsoever, and just solely based on my relationship with Him. And let's see. Started drinking at a real young age. As far as I can tell, I grew up under the influence of alcohol. I had a very fortunate upbringing. My father was a doctor, and they had these parties, and my first drink was probably about the age of five, or the age of five was when I first threw up from drinking. And my parents had this party, and they had a bartender, and the bartender and I are still good friends. He still works out in Fredericksburg. See him a lot of times. He does private parties. And I help him with the lemons and limes and the nuts and stuff on the bar, and he wasn't trying to get me drunk or under the influence or anything, but he just put like maybe a cap full, just a splash, just enough to make me giggle, think I got some, isn't this cool? What he didn't know is when he went to get more ice, I was pouring more in. And it was. I was sitting in the bathroom upstairs. My mother was sitting on the toilet seat. I was sitting in her lap, and my father was holding the trash can. And during that period of time, my mother was drinking some too. And so, that's the only reason I can figure is my father didn't think the smell was coming from me. He thought it was coming from her. And my mother was saying, "Oh, he ate too much." And at the age of five, the thought went through my head, "If she only knew." And from that point on, I'm the youngest of four. My brothers and sister are 6, 8, and 10 years older than I am. And so they had babysitters. But by the time I was coming along, they were old enough to take care of themselves. And I guess Mom figured, since there's only one of them, I'll take him wherever we go. So I went to all the parties with them. And oftentimes I was the only kid there, but, that's the way it was. I grew up more comfortable with older people because that's just where I was and what I did all the time. And they loved me because I always offered to go get them another drink. And what they didn't know is every time I was getting them another drink, I got another drink. And, it was the only way I felt comfortable. It was the only way I could the big book talks about being restless, irritable, and discontented. My phrase for it was inadequate insecurity. insecure and out of place. I just always felt inadequate, insecure, and out of place until I had a few drinks. And I was always good. I was a chameleon. I could fit into to just about anywhere. But I didn't feel a part of anything. You know, I always wanted, you know, my parents wanted me to be with the good kids. So, you know, as long as we were drinking, I could fit in for an evening, but I never felt like I belonged. And I always wanted to go out with the fun kids. But again, you know, I just, my whole life, I never felt like I belonged. And I just want to thank y'all for being here and thank Carl and them for asking me to speak and just the ability to look around this room. You know, I mean, it's a miracle. Brenda and Vera come from Fredericksburg, and Larry, and got Bubba came, rode with me. Skip from Washington State, Jeremy from, I mean, it's incredible the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, you know, and the relationship with my God. But what we're here to talk about and then how it works, it's what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But what I like is another part of the big book where it says that each individual and their personal stories tell from his own point of view and in his own way how he developed his relationship with God. Because as far as I'm concerned, that's the only one that there is. You know. And what the program tells me and what the steps tell me is that God's inside of me. And God's inside of each and every one of you. And so as long as all I do is concentrate on my relationship with Him, then my relationship with y'all is going to be just fine. But anyway, so I did a whole lot of drinking as a kid, and I did a whole lot of drinking growing up. I was not one of these alcoholics that felt that perfection was something to be achieved. My whole life growing up, my father always wanted me to get A's and B's in school, and I'll never forget in seventh grade, I finally got all A's and B's. And I had gone to this Catholic grade school, and you know what she wrote on the back of that report card? She wrote, "This is good, but Cliff can do better." You know, 7 years I'd been trying to do something to please my father. And you know what he saw on that report card? "This is good, but Cliff can do better." You know, didn't even notice that it was all A's and B's. So I think from that point on, I got the attitude that I just need to do enough. Because even if I do what they want, it's not going to get me anything extra. You know? So I got real good at just doing enough to get by. And I got, you know, I was able to get through high school, got through college, got into law school, graduated law school. That's another thing that I was thinking about. You know, this time of year, everybody's always talking about their graduations or they're going to a graduation. I cannot remember a single graduation. I cannot tell you where they were held. If it was not for pictures and those pieces of paper I get to hang on the wall, I couldn't confirm that I did it. Yeah. And I loved alcohol. I loved hard liquor. You know, my father didn't drink a drop his whole life. But we had at the house, we had a liquor closet. Because although he didn't drink, my mother drank a little bit, and he believed in whatever somebody wanted, he wanted to have it. If you ever showed up at the house and he didn't have it, he had it the next time you came by. And he had it by the case. And since he didn't drink, he didn't pay much attention to it. So I never was a big beer drinker, even though I did, if that's all there was. I mean, my favorite drink is what you have. You know, that's all there was to it. You know, so I mean, if I had a choice, it was going to be liquor. But if I didn't have a choice, it was going to be whatever you had that was going to change the way I felt about myself. Get rid of that feeling of inadequate, insecure, and out of place. I love the fact when someone pointed out that you know, the promises that we just heard Doug read. If you put the phrase, when alcohol worked, you can put that phrase in front of any one of those promises. You know, because when alcohol worked, I didn't have fear of economic insecurity. You know, I'd buy the whole bar around with no money in my pocket. You know, when alcohol was working, you know, my experience would benefit anybody who was unlucky enough to sit next to me. You know? And I'd tell them. You know, for me, and I don't see Oliver here, but Oliver talked about it last night. I think we get in here two different ways. I think we get in here by other people telling us that you can't do what you're doing. Or we get in here because it just doesn't work anymore. And for myself, I was one that it just didn't work anymore. I mean, why in the world I did not have a DUI, I cannot tell you. Why I was able to do what I did, I cannot tell you. I drove drunk, I know, or under the influence of something every day for 20 years. I functioned well under alcohol. I won more jury trials drunk than I have sober. You know? Because there's still that little part of me that when it worked, I was no longer inadequate, insecure, and out of place. You know, the end of my drinking, and I love the fact, but Bubba, who came down here with me, Gary, excuse me, he and I have been together for 20 years now, so. He was my first client. He was. And you know, and I have to apologize to him, and I want to tell y'all what I did, because it was it's so ludicrous now that I'm in the rooms and I know what alcoholism is all about. But Gary would call me and say, you know, Cliff, they're going to violate me again. I'm in trouble again. And I'm like, what happened? He said, well, you know, I tested positive for drinking again. And I was like, now, Gary, you only go to your PO once a month, right? Yeah. And you know what day you're going, right? Yeah. Don't drink. Just don't drink. And the whole time I'm telling him that, I've got a big gulp full of vodka in my other hand. Not having a clue what that meant. Yeah. I was one that I always, you know, and I still smoke cigarettes, can't give those things up yet. But everything I've ever done that wasn't good for me, I always thought that, well, you know, I could quit if I wanted to. I just don't want to. You know. So, but needless to say, my drinking it started out mostly evenings, you know, but then eventually I started drinking at lunch. Then I started drinking at breakfast, and you know, my wife at the time taught school, so she left the house at 7 o'clock in the morning, and that first conscious thought would go through my head about 5:30 in the morning. And you know how when you're laying there on the pillow and just, you don't even open your eyes, you just have that first thought goes through your head. And for me, that was just a moment of terror. Because, and I describe it, it's like the lottery. When you see the lottery on TV and they flick that switch and all those ping pong balls go loose and they're just flying everywhere. That's what happened in my head when that first conscious thought came in. And all those ping pong balls were all the things I was supposed to do yesterday, last week, last year. And all the stuff that I needed to do today. And all the stuff I was in charge of for tomorrow. Because I was in charge of everything. You know, I knew all about God. But God didn't have anything to do with everyday life of Cliff. You know, actually, the God, as I understood, was just keeping score. And you know, he, and I wasn't doing a real good job. Well, one thing I've got to say right now, because I jump around a whole lot, this is the first time I've ever done this from a podium at a conference. But But I firmly believe that I suffer from ADD. For a while I said it was ADHD, but then I realized I'm just so damn lazy that, you know, there's no hyperactivity about me. So it is just attention deficit disorder. And as such, my thoughts just go crazy. You know, and you know, I love today they have a label for it. When I was growing up as a kid, they had a label for it too. He was just a pain in the butt. You know? And they had a cure for it then too, though. They gave me a pain in the butt. You know? You know, unfortunately today they can't do that, so you know, but that's a whole different topic. But you know that insanity, and I would have to lay there in the bed and wait for her to get up so that she'd get up and leave and go to work so that I could get up and get to the freezer and get that first drink of vodka. And you know, I did that every day for 6 months. You know, God was good to me. I wasn't working much. I wasn't making much money, but she was making enough to support us, thankfully, and keep the bills paid. And I was just, God knew that I had to drink every drink I drank because he gave me the opportunity to do it. One of my last cases that I had was representing a local bar in Fredericksburg against the Virginia ABC board. The ABC board was trying to take their liquor license. And it was the same day as the Oklahoma City bombing, because I remember us being at lunch and watching the TV and seeing that on the TV while we were having a few drinks during the break and going back, and I won that case. And so I got to drink for free at that bar for my last 6 months. Yeah, I mean, it was good. You know, I'd gone through my quarter collection already. I used to collect those little bicentennial. I didn't collect them. I just put the bicentennial quarters, I put them in a separate box. And at the end of my drinking, I was going into the liquor store in my coat and tie and suit and everything. And I'm getting half gallons with all quarters. You know? And I just saw the manager of our local liquor store at the bank yesterday. And we were laughing about that, and I told her I was just talking about her on Thursday night, that I used to tell them that, yeah, I had a client pay me in all quarters. And she said, we didn't believe you then either. Yeah. But, hey, what can I say? I believed me, you know? I was able to keep up the facade. So, and yesterday was also Bob Barker and The Price is Right. I tell you what, because my schedule at the end of my drinking was 7 o'clock, start drinking, sitting around the house, someone said it earlier, with the drapes drawn, the doors locked, not answering the telephone, in my little terry cloth robe with a half gallon of vodka in my lap, just crying, just knowing that, you know, I've got every opportunity in the world has ever been given to me, and there I was frozen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And so I'd sit there and I'd watch TV, and I'd watch until Bob Barker and The Price is Right came on, and then I'd watch that, and I'd yell at those stupid people because they don't know how to play the game. And you know, yesterday when Gary and I were getting ready to come, I stopped by the house to pack my suitcase, and I just flicked on the TV while I was packing. 11 o'clock. Come on down. You know? And you know, yesterday was Bob Barker's last show. So I got to watch the last show. And I went ahead and I sat down and watched it. And I cried at the end of it. Just because, and I wasn't crying because it was the end of Bob Barker and The Price is Right. I was crying because of where I was 12 years ago and where I am now. You know, 12 years ago, the next thing I had to do was I had to put on my coat and tie, and Gary was talking about the way he stayed in my life the whole way through was he was the cook at the bar. And he said last night at dinner, was telling Skip and I that, you know, they didn't open the bar until like 4 o'clock, but they'd all get there to start cleaning up about 1 o'clock, and I was sitting in the parking lot. every day when they arrived. And it was a great place because they had a dartboard, they had a foosball table, they had, you know. And eventually, and he said it, eventually I'd come in there and I'd ask them for a drink and they'd say, you know where it is. Just get it yourself. Which is wonderful for an alcoholic. The day finally came when my drinking was going to hurt somebody else. I had another client with a thing with the ABC. And on September 27th was going to be the hearing in 1995. So September 26th, 1995, I ran into treatment to hide. By that point, there was no way. It used to be I'd drink until all those ping pong balls were calmed down, and then I could relax and have fun. So, but by that point, they never stopped. There was just no stopping them. You know, could not drink enough to get rid of that feeling of inadequate, insecure, and out of place. And the big book describes it because a lot of people, sometimes I feel unworthy to be in here because I've never been in jail. I've never been locked up. I never had anybody tell me I had to stop drinking. You know, and I thank God they did because I know if someone had told me I had to stop drinking, I'd be dead right now because I would do it until I died. But because I got to the point to where it didn't work, and this is the only part that I'm going to read, because otherwise I love this big book. Everything, if it ain't in the big book, if I say something and it's not in the big book, then tell me about it and tell me I'm wrong and tell me I'm full of crap. Because if it ain't in the big book, then it's something I'm making up. And, you know, the stuff I made up got me where I was, and I don't want to be there anymore. But in a vision for you, where it says, the less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then would come oblivion. And the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. And when I read that, that just described me to a T. I was absolutely nothing but terrified. My first year of recovery, first 6 months of recovery, I printed that paragraph up on a whole sheet so that it was as big as this. And I did it in that horror font that's got blood that drips down off the lettering. You know, looks like it's. And I had that everywhere. I had that in my bathroom, in my bedroom, in the kitchen, where I used to store the liquor, you know, everywhere. Because that described me to a T, you know. And then over on the next page where it says, he cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place he will wish for the end. And that I knew, because that's what I wanted. And I loved what one person, the way they described it is, when I was drinking, I wanted to die, but I was too afraid to die. I was chicken. And now that I've found the relationship with my higher power and you people, you know, I'm no longer afraid to die, but I don't want to miss a single day until he's ready for me. You know, life is absolutely incredible. So I went into treatment. And it was wonderful. I absolutely loved it. I'm one of those sick people that I have loved it ever since the day I arrived. And the treatment, it was safe, it was secure. The food was pretty good. The people were nice. And you know, I'd have stayed there forever. And you know, I think God knew that. Because on Thursday, I went on the 27th, so the 28 days weren't supposed to be up until the 25th of the next month. But on the 12th of October, they called me in and they said, the insurance company said you're not bad enough. You've got to go home tomorrow. And I tell you, you talk about terror. You know, thank God it was a lockdown facility, because I knew where the liquor store was. I'd been down to that same treatment center to visit my nephew. And so I knew where the, but I didn't do it. And so it was Friday the 13th of October 1995 that they drove me back up to Fredericksburg and they dropped me off. And thankfully, you know, a little part of me was still different, because most of the people in the treatment center that I went to was a blue collar place. And I was an attorney. I wore a coat and tie. So kind of part of me on the way was like, you know, all right, it's good there, but you're going back to Fredericksburg, where you're born and raised, where you're a lawyer, where you, you know, where I've got something to, you know, as if I had something left to keep up. But you know, that first night I got back there and I looked in the phone book like they told me to do, and I found AA. And I called the intergroup, and they told me there was a 7 o'clock meeting at the Trinity Church at the corner of William Street and College Avenue. And I went to that meeting, and the speaker that night was wearing a coat and tie. He was a stockbroker. He talked about going to his 2 martini lunches and never making it back to the office. He told my story. And thank God he did. Because I still didn't have a full understanding of what an alcoholic was, you know, the powerlessness that I have over alcohol. Yeah, I always thought that the, you know, alcoholism, the insanity of alcoholism, was the stupid stuff we did when we were drinking. Yeah, and you know, I mean, doing backflips down stairwells, and you know, at one point I thought I was the safest driver on the road, because they say you have 2.3 alcohol-related accidents in your life, and I'd already had 4. So, you know, statistically, I was the safest guy out there. And so I thought that that's what the insanity of alcoholism was. And someone pointed out to me, they said, Cliff, if you give anybody a half gallon of vodka before lunch, they're going to do stupid stuff in the afternoon. They don't need to be an alcoholic to do stupid stuff when you put that much in your body. That's not the insanity of the alcoholism. The insanity of the alcoholism is the fact that when I didn't want to drink again, I drank again. For a long time, just these past couple of years, is where I've come to accept that and realize that that's what I had. That was another thing about thinking I could always stop anything. It was just a matter of wanting to do it. And so for all the years before, there were many days I woke up in the morning and I said, I'm not going to do it again. I'm not going to do it. Come 5 o'clock, I changed my mind. You know? And then a little while later, I'm not going to do it again. Hell, I changed my mind by lunchtime. And at the end, I was changing my mind before I got my feet on the floor. I was saying it while I was laying in bed, but by the time I got... And so I always thought I was changing my mind. And as long as I was changing my mind, then that meant I was making the decision. When in reality, I had no choice but to change my mind. As far as I'm concerned today, I have no more choice today not to take a drink than I did the last drink I took. What I have is a relationship with a higher power, a connection to that strength and to that power that expelled that obsession to drink. You know, at first I used to not drink because I was thinking, I can't drink today, you know. And that's how I was having to go through the day. No, I can't go through it there because that'll make me think, I can't drink today. And thankfully, as a result of the steps and getting a relationship with a higher power, I don't drink today because it's been removed. I don't think about taking a drink today. The only time I think about taking a drink is when I'm talking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Otherwise, a drink it, it and it and you know I even think when I say drinking's not an option today, that's still giving me the authority to decide what the option is, and I don't do that. I had no choice but to change my mind every time I did that. And then, so finding the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I loved it from the first moment. I came in there and I told y'all that I felt inadequate, insecure, and out of place. And y'all said, well, we know why. And I was like, good. Finally, why do I feel like this? And they said, because you're inadequate, insecure, and out of place. That's why. That didn't do me much good. You know, that wasn't a whole lot of help. But, you know, thanks. And the second step for me is I'm so thankful for the people in the rooms when I got here, because they were willing to share their life and what it was like and what happened and what it was like now, that I was able to believe that they knew that inadequate, insecure, and out of place, that they had been at that point and that they had found a way out. And they said, I could do that too. And so, you know, and with it being God and a higher power, like I said, I went to the Catholic school. The last 7 years of my drinking, I was a lector at the local church in Fredericksburg. The last 2 years of my drinking, I taught Sunday school to seventh grade. I could tell you all about God. Now, like I said, the big book says that some of us had a God that was impressed upon us as a child. And that was the God that I had. Being raised that way, having to go to church every Sunday, I couldn't deny the fact that there was one, but the God that, as I understood him, I just really didn't like the guy a whole lot. But I was firmly convinced there was only one of them, so, you know, I was trying to do the best I could to get in his good graces. And and I remember when this happened. It was like third grade in catechism class, and the nun was telling us that if you weren't baptized, you were going to hell. Period. And I said, well, what about the little old guy over in the tribe that's never heard of a Bible, never heard of God, never heard of baptism, but helped everybody? Was just adored by everybody in the tribe and in the village. What about him? And she looked me straight in the face and said, no, he's going to hell. And you know, at that point, I just, like I said, I couldn't deny that he was there because he was being impressed upon me every single Sunday and every single day. But I didn't like his politics. You know? I mean, if that's what it was. And I was told he was a scorekeeper. I was told that he was keeping score, and then it just got even worse when they told me it what I thought counted as much as what I did. You know? I mean, that doubled my score right then. Because unfortunately, being inadequate, insecure, and out of place, you didn't do a whole lot, but you thought about it a lot. You know? And so that was the God of my understanding when I got here. And that's why I had to drink, because he was just keeping score. I was in charge of what I was doing. You know, I describe it, it was like the ant farms. If any of y'all remember those ant farms as a kid, where you have the ants and the two pieces of glass and the sand. You know, that was me. I was in there, and God was out here. Didn't have anything to do with it, except for maybe once a month he'd pick it up, turn it upside down, and put it back down. You know. We all used to do that too, don't lie. You know, and watch that poor little thing try and dig out. You know, and that was my relationship with God at that point. And when I found these rooms, you people told me, said, no. You can have the God that you always wanted. And you know, somewhere inside of me, I always wanted a God that loved me. That loved everybody. that was good to everybody. And y'all told me, that's good. You can have that. And it's like, yeah, but my life sucks. You know? And y'all said, yeah, but if you do these 12 steps, if you get this book, and you do these steps, life will get different. And then if you keep doing it and you get that relationship with a higher power, then that difference is going to get good. And you know, that's what happened to me. You know, I made a decision to turn my... And it was sheerly out of desperation. That's why, you know, I would love to stop anybody's elevator from going any further down if I could. And I do, and I do it to their detriment many times, I'm sure. But, you know, it took me getting as far down as I got to being willing to do it, to do what this said, to get that relationship. Like what another friend, Don, said, I was one of these people that I needed to understand it, agree with it, and think it would work in order to do it. You know, I mean, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, and I think I'm a pretty smart guy. You know, and I've got some things on the wall that people have told me I'm a pretty smart guy. So unless I understood it, agreed with it, and thought it would work, I wasn't going to do it. But thankfully, every drink I drank got me to the point of knowing what I know does not work. And I reached that point of desperation of willing to do it, even though I didn't think it would work. And I love that. Everything I say is coming from some other speaker. I love speakers. Love them all. Love Liz. Met Liz down in Atlanta. And you know, Liz, every time we have a newcomer or somebody come back into the room and the group yells, welcome, we're glad to have you, keep coming back, all of a sudden there's one more little voice. Don't leave. You know, don't leave. Because that was something that Liz said. But if I didn't agree with it, then I wasn't going to try it. And what I loved, another thing that Don said about this program, is this program doesn't care if I think it's going to work. You know? Thank God. Because if I had to wait until I thought it was going to work, I'd never be here. This program, you know, and I love his description because my dad was a doctor. He said, you know, if you have an infection in your arm and the doctor gives you a bottle with 10 penicillin pills and tells you to take one a day for the next 10 days, you know, I don't have to think it's going to work. I don't have to know how it's going to get in there and fight the bacteria and do all that stuff. You know, I don't need to be a biology major. I can actually think it's going to kill me if I take it. But if I take it the way the doctor tells me, if I follow the directions, it works just fine. No matter what I think about it. And you know, when I heard y'all tell me about doing that yourself, then I became willing to try it myself. And when I tried it myself, it worked. It was weird, you know. And it's all throughout the, you know, I love the book. When many hundreds of men and women can say that their connection with their higher power is the most important thing in their life today, they present a powerful reason on why I shouldn't have faith. You know, I love this way of life. One of the hardest parts for me is, you know, in More About Alcoholism, it talks about having to concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And that was okay. All right? I was ready to do that. But it's that next part that says that the delusion that I'm like or presently may be like other people had to be smashed. And I don't do that real well because I'm a chameleon, you know. I fit in with people. I do what other people do. I copy what you do. And that's why I've got to go to a whole lot of meetings and come to these conferences and stay around you people. Because if I don't, then I'm going to start doing what those people are doing. You know? And that's going to kill me. I was one that I thought, you know, alcoholics were just stupid, weak-willed people. You know, just don't drink. You know? As another guy says, telling an alcoholic just don't drink is like telling a homeless guy just get a house. You know, thanks a lot. You know, does me a lot of good. Yeah, doesn't work. Doesn't work. But you know, in denial. You know, in my own mind, I don't believe it's a matter of denial. You know, I've searched this book. The word denial is in here one time, and it doesn't have a single thing to do with alcoholism. Talks about the fact that father had denied the family what they deserved. The book calls it the delusion, you know, the insanity. You know, denial means I know better, but I'm going to do it anyway. And you know, if that's what I was doing, then I am just stupid. Yeah. Every time I changed my mind, I had a perfectly good and logical reason to do it. It was going to be different this time. I was going to be able to just have a couple. I was going to be able to drink like a gentleman. You know, but and so, you know, for me, that's the other part of the insanity of this, is that it is a delusion. You know, I suffer from 100 forms of self-seeking, self-delusion. Self-pity. God, I was a pitiful person. Man, it was just if y'all only knew. And another thing in here with the because for me, I was the youngest, and my brothers are 6'6" and 6'4", and they're 8 and 10 years older than I am, and so it didn't do me much good to throw my weight around. All that got was my weight thrown around the room, you know. And so I thought I had this tolerance thing down pretty good, you know. And I got things by making people happy, you know. If I wanted something from my brothers, I didn't go in there and demand it. I couldn't be mean, egotistical like what a real alcoholic was, you know. That was the other thing. It took me a long time, many times reading that page, to see that he may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest, and self-sacrificing. And I was like, wait a minute. That's me. Because I am just the nice. If y'all knew what I wanted for you, then y'all would be all over it. But y'all just never did cooperate. Yeah. So it was, you know, it was hard for me to get wrapped around. Now, wait a minute, alcoholics are, you know, they start bar fights, they go home, they beat their wives, they break furniture, they kick the dog. They're not nice people. You know, and how is it selfish and self-centered for me to be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest, and self-sacrificing? It wasn't until I realized that the only reason I was those things is so you'd like me. Yeah. That was the total selfish and self-centeredness part of it. You know, and it wasn't until I realized that the only reason I was being kind, considerate, and stuff to you is because you're the lucky person standing in front of me at that particular time. Yeah. 5 minutes, I might tell Liz I'm going to do something for her because she's standing in front of me. 5 minutes later, I see Jeremy. Well, now I got to do something for Jeremy, so, you know, hell with Liz. She's gone. You know. And then after Jeremy, I'd see Vera. It's like, oh, you know, got to forget about Jeremy. You know, I ended up working myself into sitting in my house with the lights out and the drapes drawn and afraid to answer the telephone and a bottle of vodka in my lap. By being kind, considerate, patient, generous. And you know, and it wasn't until I realized that it wasn't that I was being that to people. I was just being that to who happened to be in front of me. It didn't matter that it was Liz. It didn't matter that it was Jeremy. It didn't matter that it was Vera. who the person was didn't matter. It was just the fact that they happened to be the lucky person standing in front of me at the time. Yeah. And so I had to, you know, so I had to let go of that. Yeah. And today that makes it tough sometimes, because I still love doing stuff for people, you know. But I've always got to watch myself. I've always got to stop and ask myself, all right, are you doing this because you want them to like you, or are you doing this because it's the next right thing? And that's why I've got to do what this book tells me to do all the time. I'm pausing constantly throughout the day. When agitated or doubtful, I pause and I ask for the right thought or action. I humbly remind myself many times each day, thy will, not mine, be done. And when I do that, I get those promises. I'm much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decision. I don't tire so easily, because I'm not burning up energy foolishly like I did when I was trying to arrange the show to suit myself. And it all comes from the relationship with this higher power. You know, deep down inside, you know, that pomp, calamity, worship of other things, I was doing that big time. And you know, I can't explain why my life is as good as it is today. You know, I thank God every single day for letting me do what I do the way he lets me do it. And I'd like to say that if you took it all away, I'd still be doing it. Thank God he hadn't tested that yet. You know, because I don't know until it happens. But right now I can say that it's his will, not mine, be done. You know, and it's something. Another part in the big book, it talks about the fact that we can exercise our will. You know, there is a part, it doesn't say we ever get the power of choice back or I ever get management back, but it does say that I do get to exercise my willpower again. And in my first big book, I wrote it in all capital letters up and down the margin. Get willpower back. Yeah. But I never saw the line in front of it. Every day is a day I must carry a vision of God's will into all my activities. I can exercise my willpower along this line all I want. So it's not my will. I don't get my will back. But I get an opportunity to be a part of his will. And you know, I just don't worry about drinking anymore. At all. And I'd like to say I don't worry about what y'all think of me, but I ain't that good yet. Yeah. So I've got one story that I got to tell that I think in this one here. But the guy that said it said, once you say it three times, you don't have to give him credit. But I'm going to give it to Steve anyway. It's guy Steve B. Talks about the deal that we make with God when we do that third step. And he talks about this little old drunk stumbling down the street. And just in total despair and misery and just wishing for the end. And he bumps into God. And God's got this box. And the drunk asks him, says, what's that? And God said, this is sobriety. And the drunk says, oh, I'd give anything for that. And God, being God, said, how much you got? And the drunk says, I've got $50. And God says, well, guess what? Today, sobriety costs $50. And the drunk, being a drunk, wanted to instantly back out of the deal, said, well, wait a minute now. If I give you all $50, how am I going to put gas in my car? And God says, wait a minute, you got a car? Oh, no, 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 no. It's going to cost $50 in the car. And the drunk's like, well, if I give you my car, how am I going to get to my job? And God's like, you got a job? No, it's going to cost you your job too. Well, if I give you my job, how am I going to pay the mortgage on the house? And God's like, my gosh, your sheet is just out of date. You got a house too? It's going to cost you $50, your car, your job, your house. And the drunk says, well, what about my family? Where are they going to live? And God said, sorry, it's going to cost you your family too. And the drunk says, well, if I give you all that, what good is my life? And God said, that's right. Sobriety is going to cost you your life. And the drunk was at just that desperate moment and said, okay, I'll give you my life. And God said, good. So here's the $50. It's not your $50, it's my $50. Spend it well. And here's your car. It's not your car, it's my car. So it better not be too good for some wet drunk to throw up in. Because if it is, it's too good for me. And here's your job. It's not your job, it's my job. It's not about getting prestige and being number one or being anything else. It's about helping the rest of my kids. And here's your family. They're not your family, they're my family. And from what I understand, they don't have to talk to you again for the rest of your life with the way you treated them. But they're not your family, they're my family. But I'm going to let you take care of them for me. And here's your life. It's not your life, it's my life. Live it well and have fun. That's what it's all about. A firm believer in the fact that we get to absolutely insist on enjoying life, and that we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. Stuff still comes. But it tells me in that same paragraph that I'm to take the trouble as an opportunity to cheerfully demonstrate His omnipotence. It's a new life. It's a new world. And gosh, now I'm getting all kinds of new thoughts coming in here. But one last paragraph, and I told you I wasn't going to read another one, but I am going to read one more. All right? Because this is the one. It says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. New is what it's all about for me. I always thought I knew what freedom was, I knew what happiness was, and that all this was going to do is let me get back to that. All I had to do was change the way I went about getting to what I thought I was trying to get at. And it wasn't until it dawned on me that the word new is in this book over 70 times. A lot of it deals with New England, New York, and newcomers. But at least 30 of them are talking about a new freedom, a new sense of power, a new sense of direction, a new purpose in life. A fourth dimension of existence of which I had not even dreamed. And all I'm doing is putting handcuffs on God when I think I know where I'm going, because I don't. And anyway, I thank you for asking me, and thank you all for letting me talk to you. Love y'all.